Welcome to the Content and Media Matters podcast, a series of interviews with key leaders throughout the industry, all brought to you by the Content and Media team at Newco, a specialist global recruitment and executive search firm.
Welcome to the Content and Media Matters podcast. Your hosts today are me, Henry Johnson, consultant, and Tim Meredith, business manager. And we're delighted to be joined by Rowan de Pompere, CTO of the DPP. Rowan has an impressive 15 plus years of experience in the industry, having begun his career as a metadata architect. Rowan then worked across varying technical positions for the likes of the BBC and ITV, and now he's working across the technical, business development, editorial, and I'm sure many more areas within the DPP. Welcome to the show, Rowan.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So to get us started, we always like to ask people the same introductory question. How did you first get into the content and media industry?
Yeah, it's something that for me, I'd wanted to do for a long time. You know, as a kid at school, I don't think I had a really fixed idea of what I wanted to be when I grew up, as it were. But I had a sense from pretty early on that TV and theatre and those sorts of disciplines were interesting to me. So when I went to university, I ended up doing a degree in electronics media engineering. That was kind of part of it, but actually as much a part of it was that I got really into student TV. So I was making TV in my spare time, building TV stations in my spare time. And that kind of really, really got me enthused. So when I left uni and a possibility came up to join the graduate trainee scheme at BBC R&D, it was sort of right up my street, and that's how I got into the industry.
I don't know if you're anything like me. I did a lot of university radio. Do you have any embarrassing, extremely early footage of you on student television hanging around for people to find?
Maybe if you put my name into Google, you might find some entries into some awards or some different shows that are available. I'd probably rather people didn't, but hey, if you,
I'm in the exact same boat.
At my expense.
Student Radio Nottingham's got the dirt on me. So let's ask some questions then about your past. So I don't know if you had any sort of idols or people you particularly looked up to sort of, you know, growing up and getting into the content and media space, but, you know, what or who would you say have been the biggest influences on your career?
Yeah, I don't tend to have a whole lot in the way of idols per se, but I have been lucky over the course of my career to have a bunch of significant individuals who have mentored me, you know, managers who really kind of backed me, people that I have looked up to and learned from. So, you know, I rather than having idols, I would sort of tend to look a little bit closer to home in terms of just people I admire and who've helped me out. And there have been a number of those through my career, from the BBC and ITV. You know, probably in particular at those companies, where, you know, in the earlier parts of my career, I was supported and given opportunities to do cool stuff that challenged me. The folks who kind of gave me those opportunities and helped me to succeed at them are probably the people that are closest to my professional idols, at least.
Yeah, perfect. And sort of talking about those sort of early experiences, you know, trying to get into the space and sort of working with interesting technologies. Do you have anything that stands out as sort of like the technology that's been most exciting or enjoyable to work with over the years?
It's a great question. I think I don't tend to get motivated too much by the technology itself. I mean, I am a bit of a geek. I do love new technology, but you know what motivates me professionally is solving business problems using technology. Sure. Right, so you know, the first kind of really formative experience on that for me was probably working on the BBC HD channel. Relatively soon after it launched, there was problems with the audio video sync, particularly for surround sound. We just implemented a technology called Dolby E. There were a few teething troubles with it, and I was given sort of free rein to go and explore the signal chain, figure out where the problems were, map it out and solve those problems. That really excited me. That, you know, that really got me enthused, because it was solving a very tangible problem that was affecting viewer experience. So that was kind of a key one. And then, you know, when I went on to ITV, I was involved in putting together a series of systems to streamline production processes, you know, kind of right end to end across production from planning through to post-production. And that was super exciting because of the scope of it and the chance to you know, apply some process and technology improvements, but again, to try and make the process of making content better. Maybe a bit of a cop-out answer because it's not technologies, but those are probably two of the kind of formative experiences of problems that I got to solve, which excited me.
No, totally. And would you say, do you tend to gravitate towards those problems where it's like, look, we have got a tangible, you know, business problem that is influenced by technology, obviously, and so yes, you work from A to B, and then at the end of it you can say, look, there it is, you know, that didn't work, now it works, as opposed to, you know, important stuff where it's a little bit more holistic, you know, we increased by half a percentage point, all these different things, which makes a macro result, but it's a little harder to kind of grab onto.
Yeah, maybe. I definitely think there is something nice about tangible improvement. And you know, I mentioned I started in BBC R&D, right? And I think what I did discover reasonably early on in my career is that the sort of the longer term research and development isn't something that really gets me out of bed in the morning. Like I'm fascinated by what the teams there do. And I think, you know, there are incredibly smart people doing incredibly valuable things in organizations like that. But for me, you know, exploring a technology and trying to work out how it's going to work and how it might be applied in the future is something I'm interested to hear about, not really something I want to do every day. I want to be applying the technology now to solve today's business problems.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And obviously you've had a background as in leadership roles in the industry. Yeah. And you've led a lot of sort of global teams, people distributed all over the place, you know, something that's sort of become more and more relevant, well, even with domestic teams when the pandemic hit and people being managed remotely. Yeah. But what would you say are the sort of major challenges you faced, you know, leading global teams, leading, you know, distributed teams?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, by far and away, the biggest and most distributed team I managed was when I was at Uyala. So I was running professional services for EMEA there, but the way that the teams were structured, you know, I had a team in Guadalajara in Mexico. I had a team in Chennai in India. And then I had individuals spread across Europe as well as in London. So that was the role where I really kind of cut my management teeth. I'd only sort of looked after one or two other people before that. And it wasn't as challenging as I thought it would be to manage those distributed teams. I think the reasons being, firstly, I was pretty lucky in the quality of people that I had, and
yeah,
I had one or two challenges, you know, one or two difficult situations to get through, but not many considering, you know, the time I was there and the people I looked after. But I think the other thing was how embedded distributed working was in that company. You know, we had a sales team who were constantly on the road. My services team and my equivalents in the other regions, we were always on the road. We had a headquarters in Silicon Valley, a big office in London, a number of other offices elsewhere. And so what it meant was that it was truly embedded into the culture of the organization. Like anytime you booked a meeting with, you know, more than a one-to-one, there's like a default assumption that somebody's not in the room. So there'll be video conferencing. Everybody will be connected to it. And it was really funny for me, actually, when I came to the DPP, you know, we were still in 2018 doing phone conferences, and it was still a thing that people had to think about as to whether you needed to book some video conferencing for a meeting. And it just, it increases the friction hugely. And so I think there is absolutely something about organizational culture that you know, being just out of the gate, always thinking about having people in different places, becomes part of your blood. And so, you know, yes, it was really important to see people face to face. And, you know, it became massively easier to work with my team in Chennai after I first went there. Like, hiring people remotely was really hard. But once you've built those relationships, maintaining them in a distributed way is not too difficult, as long as it's sort of part of your default behavior, as long as it's just part of how you act every single day. I think where we get it wrong is where we make it a bigger deal than it needs to be.
Sure. No, absolutely agreed. And I think, a lot of people who had been, shall we say, a little bit more tenuous about that got a bit of a shock, you know, when the pandemic hit, and it was like, well, you didn't prepare for this, but it's happening anyway. So either get used to it or you're in trouble.
Sorry, I was going to say, it is interesting because it is a balance, right? So the DPP, we really value in-person time together. We're a small team, we're 12 people. And so we have pretty heavily gone back to being in the office for a couple of days a week and wanting to all be together. I don't think that being good at working remotely means that it's the only way things should be done, and that there isn't real value in physically getting together.
Agreed.
But the key, is just to figure out, you know, what are the things that you really want to come together for, and what can we do remotely, and then just make it as easy as you possibly can in terms of people's attitudes, as well as just the technology and that kind of stuff. Just to be okay with the fact that we're all spread around the place.
Yeah, absolutely. So great to sort of discuss past and sort of, you know, what's happened before. But let's take a look at the present day and what the future might hold. Henry?
So, Rowan, the industry is changing so quickly. It's the cloud adoption and deployment, digital transformation, AI. There is so many hot topics that we could have picked up on. Out of curiosity, is there a particular area of technology that you are particularly interested in at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, there's always a range. You know, what we do at the DPP is to analyze and think about these trends. Cloud has been huge for the last few years, and I think it became very tangible over the last sort of 3 or 4 years. In very much the mainstream. We've done a lot this year thinking about integration and how different tools and technologies work together. I think sort of data-driven decision making is super important right now, and machine learning, AI, I think are always exciting. I tend to take a pretty pragmatic view, but we're about to kick off a project called The Future of Localization, which is looking at how the world of localizing content is evolving and being driven by technology. That's a very ML heavy area, or at least has the potential to be. So, you know, I'm doing that, of course, because our members seem interested in it and tell us that they want to know about it, but also because I am personally very interested by that. Yeah. There's some cool stuff going on in that space.
Oh, no, I can imagine you get to slightly steer the direction as well when it comes to those interesting areas. And I mean, you get this front row seat, I imagine, to the industry with the successes and the pain points. And do you think that there is a general challenge at all facing the industry at the moment, technology-wise?
I don't think the biggest challenge is technology right now. I think, you know, that there are macroeconomic challenges. There are huge skills challenges. I mean, I think, you know, if you want to anchor it to technology, a lot of the problem is getting the people who have the right skills and the right knowledge into media businesses. It's something that member companies tell us every single day that, you know, whether it's in software engineering, whether it's actually even the sort of more traditional broadcast engineering skills now, because, you know, a lot of the folks who really have that expertise do tend to be older, and they're starting to transition out of the organization. You know, with software, it tends to be more because there's competition from every other industry for the same kinds of people that we want. So yeah, I don't think it's a challenge with the technology itself so much as our ability to capitalize on it.
No, I completely understand. And I think the demand is crazy. I mean, from the back of IPC as well. So we can certainly echo that. And I mean, this could be either personal or within work life. What are you most excited about in the future?
Wow, big question.
Big question. That's a loaded one for sure.
We're a show that asks the biggest of questions, right?
I mean, I might be segueing into something that you were probably going to ask me about anyway, but you know, the thing that is exciting me most at the moment is the future of the DPP, because we've recently announced some structural changes that allow us to take very direct control of that, and I am super excited about how we can continue to grow this network that we've created, how we can build on what we've done so far to do ever more. And you know, we're now, as a leadership team, really in the driving seat of doing that. So yeah, that does excite me a lot, and sort of spans professionally what we can achieve, but also personally, you know, what is it gonna mean for my own sense of success and satisfaction.
Oh, well, that takes us really, really nicely, Rowan, into the topic that matters. Tim, I will hand over to you.
Yes, and first of all, thank you for answering that and skirting around the exact nature of my question, so I didn't get to hear it, just have to sort of panic. But yeah, so our sort of, you know, topic that matters that we chose for this week was very much linked to the DPP, in that recently you announced that you are becoming a fully independent organization, and first of all, congratulations on that.
Thank
very
you.
Huge milestone. So we'd just like to know a little bit more about this. You know, how did it come about, and sort of why it's so, you know, why it's so important for you and for the DPP and what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, for anybody who's listening and doesn't know the history of the DPP, started out of the UK as a collaboration between broadcasters that started to bring in, you know, production, post-production companies, technology vendors, and more. So in 2015, it was incorporated as its own company, but with shareholders of the BBC and ITV and Channel 4. So we've been a membership organisation since then. We've been growing that membership, you know, pretty rapid rate. We are, you know, we've got our sights on 500 member companies, not too far away. And I think what's critical about that is that membership is increasingly very, very international. You know, we've had a strong presence in the US for quite some time. You know, most of the major US media giants are members of the DPP. We've been growing rapidly in Europe recently, and you know, the tech firms, the service providers that we work with, they tend to be very international themselves. So wherever they're based doesn't really matter. They'll be operating across multiple territories. So, you know, what that means is, you know, while we are incredibly grateful for the support that the BBC and ITV and Channel 4 have given us over the last few years, it was starting to feel, you know, maybe almost a little incongruous to have three UK public service broadcasters owning this organisation that was increasingly focused on an international membership. And they've been very good at letting us as a management team kind of do what we needed to do to serve the needs of our members. But we felt increasingly that the time was right for us to, you know, truly stand on our own two feet, for those UK broadcasters to sort of take the role of a member in exactly the same way as major media companies in other countries do, rather than sitting on our board. So, you know, that's the kind of change that we've made, is that they've stepped back from being shareholders. And we've brought in some non-exec directors as well to help us kind of develop the business and grow the offering that we provide to our members. So that's the kind of genesis of it and why it matters to us. And you know, for us, it just means that we've got now, you know, full kind of scope to continue to grow that membership, continue to grow what we offer those members, and you know, do our very best to deliver more value going forward.
And I imagine there's a lot of sort of long-term plans, you know, tied to that change and tied to what it means that you can do. But do you have anything you can tell us about sort of what you have coming up, sort of, you know, short to medium term, and what sort of, you know, your members and other people in the broadcast media space can expect to see?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's not a lot of change in the short term. You know, we do fundamentally believe that what we've been building, what we've been offering in terms of a membership community, a network of companies across the industry, supported by events and, you know, research and insight and our technology collaboration work, is the right model. You know, we're not sort of making any dramatic change from that. What we are doing is strengthening our own team in terms of how we deliver that work, thinking very carefully about where we would really like to grow our membership. You know, I think there are some key areas of focus that we'll have. You know, our most recent major event that we started is called the European Broadcaster Summit. That took place for the first time this year. It'll happen again next year. That probably tells you something about, you know, the fact that we want to make a real commitment to the continent of Europe. And then, of course, we're planning our editorial topics for next year. I mentioned localization. We've got some work around monetization of content, got some work around smart working planned. So a lot more that we'll be sharing soon. But really, it is for now about, you know, doubling down on doing what we do even better.
Got it. It's really exciting to hear, Rowan. There is definitely some big plans ahead for sure. And I suppose a bit of another loaded question here for me. I don't suppose you mind taking us way back and giving us a bit of context about how the DPP was formed. Where did the idea come from, and what were those first steps like?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's been an interesting journey. I've been in and out of it personally. So, you know, it was founded by our CEO, Mark, and the chair of our board, Helen. We're sort of the founders of Digital Production Partnership Limited in 2015 when it was set up. But prior to that, it, as I say, was an informal collaboration. It was the UK broadcasters coming together to solve some challenges they had around the transition to end-to-end digital working, which is a phrase that frankly seems a bit quaint these days. But, you know, that really led to us publishing the common format that is used for delivering TV programs by file to every UK broadcaster. And in those early days, I was in a lot of those technical working groups that were sort of setting those formats. So it's kind of an interesting thing, because we started with that technical collaboration, but I think what was remarkable about what the team then achieved was they recognized that publishing a spec was a very small part of the job, and actually what you really needed to do was to get the industry together to understand the implications and to get behind the implementation of that spec. And so it's that network that was built that really laid the foundations for the DPP becoming a membership organization and evolving into what it is today. And what we found is that, you know, getting together to discuss problems, share ideas, and exchange insights is really what people demand from us. So that's kind of how it's evolved over the years since then.
Interesting. No, it's fascinating to hear, and there are certainly some exciting things coming in the future. And I will now hand over to Tim to cover the topic of diversity and inclusion.
Yes, so this is something we include in every show, and it's really interesting to have people like yourself on, because you've been in, you know, a members organization, an organization at the center of, you know, lots of broadcasters in Europe, all of whom will have, you know, their own thoughts and feelings on this and sort of action points to improve it. So I'll sort of start off by asking, you know, given that you've had this front row seat, how have you seen, you know, attitudes towards diversity and change throughout your career? And then sort of the little addendum to that, because you're doing international, you know, has it been sort of equally across Europe, or have you felt it's sort of been a bit of a patch of progress?
Yeah, it is an interesting one. Diversity is hugely important to us at the DPP. It's been a big focus for us for a number of years. And the way that we approach it is to just try and live and breathe it. You know, we pay incredible attention to the speaker lineups at our events. We've made huge progress. If you look at Leaders Briefing, our flagship event, if you look at the gender diversity of that event in terms of speakers, it's got better and better year on year. Still more work to be done. We're actually focusing increasingly now on attendees at our events as well, because it matters for the audience if you turn up and feel that you're surrounded by people who are nothing like you or who are like you. That makes a big difference to your experience. So, we care a lot. It's something that I think, we do see as really resonating across the industry now. You look at the success of groups like Rise, and they're doing incredible work. We support them, both in terms of partnership, sponsoring them, and we have, a close relationship with them because we think that they're doing incredibly valuable stuff. They've got real resonance across the industry for that. So I think that's really positive to see. To your question about does it differ in different locations, I actually don't think so. I think maybe it gets a little more focus in some places than others, but when we go to the US and do our events or our bits of work there, this is still a big issue and people understand it and it resonates. When we're going into continental Europe, the same is true. Bluntly, we've got quite direct about the way that we approach this now. We do get on the phone to speakers that we've had in the past and say, look, you were great last year, but we need to not have the same lineup of middle-aged white men that we had last year. We want you to help us find the great women in your organization, the great rising stars in your organization. And frankly, we'd like you to give up your speaking slot for somebody else who looks different to you. And that actually, those conversations you can have now, and people are receptive to it because they all get it. I think it is, it's something that has come a long way. So much more work to be done.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and it's interesting he said, because often, we have people on this show that, not without merit, will say, we're a purely technical organization and we're trying to hire engineers. And it's a bit of a grassroots problem for us because the number of people that come through, the enrollment rate into technical courses is often quite, decent in terms of like gender and ethnic diversity. And then it's dropped off, it just drops off and off and off in the first couple of years after graduation. So they're often saying, it's a grassroots problem. We need more people in here, need more people in there. But then we think, well, that's lovely. But that's sort of slightly putting the cart before the horse in a weird way, because seeing like yourself on a panel, speaking about their time in the industry, modeling that, so it kind of is an obvious viable option as opposed to something you're the first person who's ever trying to do it, is massively important. And it feels like the DVP is kind of trying to push that and not saying, well, let's go to schools and say, enroll in them.
We're trying. As I say, we're far from perfect. By the way, I think transparency on these things is important. So let me tell you our stats. In our team, we are 50-50 gender balanced right now.
Yeah.
Six women, six men make up our team as of today. However, to your point, our exec team, three white men, fortunately. Yeah. That
three white men on this podcast as well, further transparency.
Right, exactly. Our board is one third female. We are getting there. But of course it's not just about gender. There are many, many facets to this. Ethnic background is a relatively sort of nascent area of focus, I think, in terms of our industry. We've been rightly concerned about gender representation, but there's more to be done in other areas. There's a lot more that we can do. And to your point about the podcast, Tim, I did take a look before this. 8 out of the last 50 guests were women, so that's around about 16%. So let me go on the record as saying I will happily provide you some suggestions for future guests, because we did
have Carrie Wooten on from Rise, but that's not all of it. So yes, if you do have now, our director, John, we do sort of submit our list of podcast guests, and that does sort of, the raised eyebrow does come up, and now the women, please. So, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Perfect. Well, thank you for your thoughts there. Very much appreciate that. But let's sort of bring it back to you and, yeah, let our listeners know a little bit more about you outside of work. Henry.
So we've learned about your work life already, Rowan, but I'm sure we'd all like to learn a bit more. We're a curious bunch. So what would you say would be your ideal weekend?
I'd be out on the water. So I sail. I absolutely love to sail. I grew up by the sea. So the very least I'd be somewhere by the sea, but preferably I'd be sailing. In an ideal world, somewhere warm. I am more of a gin and tonic kind of a sailor than a, you know, serious racer or anything. Though whether that's practical just for a weekend trip to fly down to the Med or something, I don't know. That might not do my sustainability credentials much good.
No, life is too short though. Our director John, is it kite surfing, Tim? Is it windsurfing?
He's all sorts. He's got this board with a blade on it and it rises up out of the water and he flies around. I can't remember what it's called, but the pictures look great.
Foiling.
Wind foiling. Exactly.
This stuff is super cool.
I don't know how he does it in the rain and goes into the wind. Not for me, so to say. But we always like to finish up, Rowan, with one final question. What is one piece of advice you would give to someone entering the industry?
Great question. I think I would say, if you don't ask, you don't get. And what I mean by that is this. I have through a number of times in my career, you know, had conversations with the company I'm working for, with the manager I'm working for, about what I would like to achieve in terms of the things I'd like to work on, the things I'd like to deliver, the types of roles I'd like to head towards. And, you know, I'd like to be very clear, a number of times the answer is no, because ultimately you work for a company and they have, you know, particular business needs and you know, you are there to deliver for the company. But equally, remarkably often the answer has been yes. You know, I've literally sat in an organization that's going through a reorg, looked at the new structure, phoned up the manager of the team that I think looks most interesting and said, I'd really be interested in coming and working in your team. What would be the chances? And following a coffee and a bit of chat, being able to do that and go and work in that team and work on things that I was really passionate about. So, you know, I mean, you've got to have realistic expectations. You've got to have a bit of humility, but also being thoughtful and being open and honest about what you want to achieve. It's amazing how often you can make steps that you want. People won't come and hand things to you on a plate if you don't ask for it.
Absolutely. Wonderful. Well, that does bring us to the end of the show. Thank you so much for your time, Rowan. Great to hear all your thoughts and insights on those topics. A real pleasure to have you on the show, and thanks very much for coming on.
No worries. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you enjoyed it, please do subscribe and give us a rating. It really helps these stories to be found and enjoyed by more people. For more information about NewCo, we can be found at www.newco-group.com. That's NEUCO-group.com.